A bit over a year ago, I started, I went back into the Old Testament and started my devotions, my devotional study, my Lectio Divina study is what I normally do. I went back into the Old Testament because I had read a book by an author named Sandra Richter called The Epic of Eden, and it had inspired me to go back into the First Testament and to find the Lord there. And so I started at 1 Samuel, and I did my what I customarily do is I read a chapter a day, and I listen for the voice of the Spirit in the text, and then I journal on that, and I pray what I have journaled in, and I have a rich time. It's a rich time every day because I get to hear the Lord every single day. Well, I go through the Samuels, 1 and 2 Samuel, and then 1 and 2 Kings. All good to go. 1 and 2 Chronicles, then Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, and then, you know, hit the brakes, Job. Oh, no. And for me, when I hit Job, I just thought, you know, Lord, this sequential thing, this isn't really necessary, right? I don't have to keep going. And I was thinking about all kinds of ways that I could leapfrog Job. And I really didn't want to go into Job because there's just too much griping and too much religion in it. And it's just a very difficult book, or it has been for me in the past. And so I felt a bit like a dog that somehow knows it's going to be taken to the vet. And all of a sudden, you know, paws dig in, and it's like everything that they can do to keep from going in that direction. And somehow they know that, and in my soul, that was what was going on. And I tried to leapfrog it, but eventually I started. And to my utter surprise, God met me very powerfully throughout a little bit more than a month's worth of study in the book of Job. It's 43 chapters and going a chapter a day. I was thinking, I'll just go two or three chapters a day. It was so rich, and I have to say, I loved it. Because Job it examines so many different complex things and the complex fabric of how God and suffering work in our universe. And it addresses in part, not in full, but it addresses in part, in a beautiful way, the ultimate questions that we ask about the problem of suffering and the problem of evil. And those are very hot topics. They have been in the body of Christ way back before Jesus walked on the earth. They have been issues that people that have been people of faith have wrestled with for millennia. That these are hot topics for us. And these kind of questions like, you know, why do bad things happen to good people and good things to bad? Why or how can God be all good and all powerful, yet there's still evil and suffering in the world? And those are ultimate questions. Would you agree? But I think most of the time we want to keep those at bay. But basically, Job invites us into this idea of looking at suffering with faith and truth. And so that's what we're calling this series, Looking at Suffering with Faith and Truth. Now, it challenges our easy formulas. It challenges our answers that we just sort of chicken soup for the soul kind of quotes and those different things. It challenges these things because life is more complex. Life is more nuanced. Life is a very complex fabric of things. And if we're going to examine suffering honestly, I think Job is actually a brilliant introduction into it. Now, Job is one of the earliest books in the Bible. A lot of scholars think it's the oldest book in our Bibles. And because of that, it is also, actually, it's also called wisdom literature along with the Proverbs and Ecclesiastes. Now, Proverbs basically describes how godly character generally leads to success. In general, it does. Not always, but in general. Ecclesiastes sort of tempers this, sort of in an Eeyore type of a fashion, by warning us that success is not necessarily guaranteed in this world because the world is crooked. This is a crooked place that we live. And then Job takes that musing from the writer of Ecclesiastes a step further in looking at suffering and our responses to it. So the big idea of what we're going to look at this morning is that, firstly, we're going to introduce Job, a righteous man, a truly righteous man, and whose motives and beliefs are challenged through loss and suffering. And he responds in surrender and trust. He is for us a model of what trust looks like in loss. And throughout this book of Job, we're going to see that. Now, just so that you know, there are 42 chapters in Job. I'm not going to preach 42 messages on this. I don't think I could take it. and I don't think that you would either. I want a church to be here when we're done. But we're probably going to take 4, 5, 6 messages and do this because there's a lot of redundancy in the middle. There's sort of bookends on both sides that have a lot of meaning, and then a whole bunch of dialogue between Job and 3+ friends that in the middle that have a lot of redundancy to them. And so we'll generalize and focus on those in a different way. But when we're here's where I'm going with this, and just as by way of objective, is that Job is an invitation into thoughtful interaction with God on why we suffer. And if you've had much experience in life, you've suffered some. The studies basically show that people have, in general, most people experience at least 7 traumatic events in their life. I've found that that's just seeming to be very low. That people experience a lot of trauma. And Job actually causes us to think thoughtfully or to be thoughtful in our interactions with God. Now, it's important to say at the very beginning, and I wrestled with whether I should include this or not, but I think it's helpful in an overview, and so I give you this warning at the beginning. You might want to take a picture of these 2 slides that I'm going to give you in just a moment so that you can look back at them on your own time. But they're not in your bulletin because there's just simply not enough room. But the Bible doesn't give one cohesive answer to the problem of evil and the problem of suffering. It gives, rather, a number of Polaroid shots, all of them true, but all of them are insufficient in themselves. All of them contain some part of the answer, but the Bible actually does not address the problem of suffering directly and in one fell swoop. It's not encyclopedic, if you will, with regard to that. But what it does say, and here are 10 things that the Bible says about suffering, that suffering occurs because of Satan and the powers of evil, that actually evil causes evil and somehow God allows it, but not all of it. Secondly, that suffering comes because of human free choice, that people hurt people. Thirdly, that suffering, the Bible sees it as punishment or as retribution, that you reap what you sow, and so suffering comes from that. Another dimension, fourthly, is suffering discipline. That is different than punishment. That is, it's sort of punishment that teaches us, as the writer of Hebrews says. Another thing that suffering does in the Bible is it opens our eyes to ourselves. And it opens our eyes to the world. So suffering is revelatory. It shows us for what we are, the world for what it is, and God for who he is. Sixthly, that suffering is seen in the Bible in places like Isaiah 48:10, the furnace of affliction, or in Zechariah 13:9 as this refining fire, this way that God uses these bad things that happen in our lives to actually refine us and to make us better versions of ourselves. Seventhly, the Bible says that suffering is temporary, that it is not permanent. And the beautiful thing about the gospel is it says that something is coming that we will not be disappointed with, but this present suffering that we're going through will not last, but eternity will. And eternity with God will. Eighth, suffering is, for one, and the writer of Ecclesiastes just said, it's just plain meaningless. It's like, what in the world is this all about? And I love and I hate Ecclesiastes all at the same time because it's like, dude, you really got some problems. You have some issues. Ninth, the Bible describes suffering in an eschatological, that is, as things get worse, as things are about to wrap up at the end of the human timeline, things will get worse in that and suffering will come with that. And then lastly, the 10th thing is that suffering and evil are mysterious. That they're bigger than us, but that God is wise enough to know the answers. And so, having said all of that, the narrator of this story introduces us to a non-Jewish man in a non-Jewish territory in the land of Edom, southeast of Israel. He introduces us to this non-Jewish man named Job. And that brings us to Job 1. In the land of Uz, that's how you say that, there lived a man whose name was Job. This man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, so 10 kids in all, and he owned 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 donkeys, and had a large number of servants. He was the greatest man among all the people of the East. So the narrator, firstly, wants us to know that Job is a truly righteous man, that he fears God. And he's upright. It doesn't mean that he's perfect, but he's upright. He's a man who is right with God. And in the Old Testament framework, this is how a writer would say this, that someone who is righteous is right and upright before God. And indeed, we'll find out later that this is actually how God sees Job as well. But it's important to say at the very beginning that this is the very thing that's going to be challenged throughout the book of Job. And so it's important to establish that this is what the narrator says, this is what God confirms, and this is what the friends are going to say is not so for the entire book. And it's actually very frustrating, but again, this sets the tenor. Now, there are three Hebrew words for the word fear. Reverence is one, fear is another, and terror is another. This is the middle word. This is the word that we should feel when we know we're going to stand, when we're thinking about standing in front of God and giving an account for our lives, everything that we said and everything that we do. We should fear that moment. That's the word that's being used here. And Job has that. And it says that this word is always used in association with this idea of being completely integrous, of being a person of complete character and integrity. That's Job. He's the real deal. He's a rare human specimen. And it says he's blessed and he's a great man. And then it says in verse 4, his sons used to hold feasts in their homes on their birthdays, and they would invite their three sisters and eat and drink with them. And when a period of feasting had run its course, Job would make arrangements for them to be purified. Early in the morning, he would sacrifice a burnt offering for each of them, thinking, perhaps my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. This was Job's regular custom. So Job is also a loving and concerned parent. I mean, it's a really big deal to him, and he's afraid just in case his kids partying got a hold of them in a bad way, he wants to intercede for them. I know what this feels like as a dad of a father of four, that my kids made some seriously questionable kinds of decisions, and all we could do, because we had no control over them, was to pray and intercede as best we could. This is Job. He prays and he intercedes. Then it gets interesting. So it says in verse 6, one day, the angels in the NIV or Son of Your translation say, sons of God, heavenly beings, let's just say, came to present themselves before the Lord. And Satan also came with them. And the Lord said to Satan, where have you come from? And Satan answered, from roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it. Now, okay, so this is unique, wouldn't you say? That here's a sort of a all hands on deck, all heavenly hands on deck, assembly before God, and one character, the Satan, chimes in. Now, you think, and if you're anything like me, it's like, what? You know, how in the world does Satan get in on this meeting? But what's interesting is that because this is a very early writing in the Old Testament, the Jews do not have the concept of Satan that we have from Jesus. And the concept, the Jewish concept of Satan as a demon, as a personified evil, doesn't come until much later than the book of Job was written. And literally, this word in the Hebrew in Job is the Satan. And that's much better translated the accuser or the adversary, or as theologian Marv Adon would put it, the provocateur, the one who asks the hard questions. That he's the one, he's really the devil's advocate, much more so than the devil himself. The Satan is actually literally what it says. And so our translators have not done us a favor in translating this. It's more of a title, it's not a proper name. And so we're talking about someone who's asking the hard questions. Does that make sense so far? Really important to understanding the book of Job, because if you think that this is Satan in the way that we know Satan from Jesus and his ministry, then you're not going to hear what the original audience heard, and that's what we want to hear, what the original audience heard in the framework that they heard it, so that we can get the message that we're supposed to get from it. Does that make sense? So very important. Now, if you want to get a little bit more information on this, a brilliant and beautiful overview of this is done by the Bible Project. If you go to thebibleproject.com and you listen to it, it's very short, but it's a very beautifully and well done sort of introduction to the book of Job. I really would encourage you doing that as we go through this. It's because the book is beautiful and they do a great job in looking at that. So then from there, and I'm going to use the Satan in the rest of the translation as I'm talking this to you so that you know that. Because I don't want you to mistake this for the same, you know, Satan that Jesus is talking about in the New Testament. Because again, the Jews just would not have had that concept to even apply to it at that point in time. So it says, then the Lord said to the Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and an upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. Now, first blanch for me in this, I want to say, Lord, please don't ever say this about me. Right? I do not want to be in the crosshairs of the evil one because the Lord has showed me off. Please, you know, can we not do that? But here we see, as I said before, how God sees Job. Job is seen by God himself as a righteous man. He's the real deal, a rare and great man to God. But the Satan chimes in. Does Job fear God for nothing? He replied. Have you not put a hedge around him and his household and everything he has? Have you blessed the work of his hands so that his flocks and his herds are spread throughout the land? But now, stretch out your hand and strike everything he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. And so the Satan basically says to Job, it says to God, Job's working the system. He knows that you're the sort of cosmic vending machine, the cosmic sugar daddy, and so he does the things that will get the result that he wants. And so as soon as he doesn't get the result that he wants, he'll turn on you. And that's the argument that's being given, that as soon as you stop blessing him, his devotion to you will crumble. He doesn't really love you. He just loves what comes from you. Really important question. Now, this begs the question of us. Let me slow this down for a moment. This begs the question of us. Do we love God because of his blessing or because of who he is? Do we love God for what comes from God or for who he is? Think about that for a moment. I think that there's many looky-loos in the church today, basically, that are believers so long as it goes good and as long as we're all good, you know, then that's great. I'm willing to be a Christ follower as long as all good. But then when it goes south, when something happens, I have seen people bolt from the faith so quickly, it was like, what happened to you? Now, when something bad happens, or the benefits package somehow is in question or is yanked out from under us, who is it that we love? Is it the benefits, or is it the one who's giving the benefits? Now, for me, as I was journaling on this, I had to kind of take this a little bit deeper. I had to ask the question and ponder this with the Lord aloud, why do I do what I do? Why? Do I do it because I want to please God? Or do I do it because I want to please myself? Or please others and so therefore please myself because I feel good because they like me? Or do I do it so that I'll get some certain result? Or that I may feel more secure? Why do I do what I do? Do I do it so that I'll feel more valuable? And I want to ask you that question this morning. Why do you do what you do with regard to God? Why? Think. It's not an easy one. And I think as we spend the time and maybe take the time to ask God and listen for his Spirit's probing answers, it might get a little uncomfortable. But please understand that God would only challenge certain things about our character and about our motives because he wants to lead us into that which is truly life, not which is death. But I had to admit that when I did this in my own time, the Lord really challenged some things in me. And it was hard. It was like, oh, that isn't very pretty. Why do you do the things you do with regard to God? Why? That brings us to verse 12. Then the Lord said to the Satan, I know this is weird for you because you're like, that's Satan, but it's actually Hasatan in Hebrew. Then the Lord said to the Hasatan, very well then, Everything he has is in your power. But on the man himself, do not lay a finger. Then the Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. And so firstly, this exposes one dimension of how evil and suffering impact our world. That is to say that the invisible, or we'll call it the spiritual realm, actually directly impacts or interacts with the visible realm and causes suffering. Let me say that one more time. That the invisible realm directly interacts with the visible realm and causes suffering. Now, for most people in the world, they would say, of course. But all of us in the West, in America, and in Europe, and everybody that buys our kind of paradigm of thinking, we don't tend to think that the things that we can't detect with our own senses are actually real. But they are. And so what ends up, I remember years ago, I was at a class at Fuller Seminary on missionary anthropology. And on the first day of the class, the missionary professor walks in. He's dressed in striped pants, a paisley shirt, and a flowered tie. Classic missionary wear. Please, no. And he situates himself at the front of the class and then says, how many of you, and I'm in a class, mind you, that's full of 2/3 world students of every color and tongue on the planet, and then there's a few of us Americans in there. He asked the question, how many of you believe that this room is full of spirits? Instantly, all the 2/3 world people go, you know, their hands go up. And all of us Americans, we're like, we don't want to be embarrassed, you know. We're like, well, I suppose theoretically, that's so. And then he paused for a moment and he said, now, how many of you know this room is full of spirits? All the Americans' hands go down. Then he followed that up with this assertion. He said, what you see and what you see with this response is what we call worldview. That is how a given people and culture view what is real and unreal, what is possible and impossible. And so for you Americans, you do not see that the invisible realm is real because you cannot detect it with your five senses. Yet everyone else in the entire planet knows this to be certain. The invisible realm has an impact on the visible realm, whether we like it or whether we don't, whether we recognize it or whether we don't. It doesn't mean, and I think that we can go on two sort of sides of this, we can overemphasize it thinking there's a demon under every bush, or we can underemphasize it and saying that the devil is already defeated and so he's just a bee without a stinger and no cause to even think about him. No, the truth is somewhere there in the middle, and the Apostle Paul addresses this in Ephesians chapter 6, where he's talking about spiritual warfare, and he says it this way. He says, we're not fighting against flesh and blood enemies. So you're not fighting against your brother and your sister, or even the mayor of Ephesus at this point in time. He said, we're not fighting against flesh and blood enemies, but against evil rulers and authorities in the unseen world, against mighty powers in this dark world, and against evil spirits in the heavenly places. This whole idea of that there's something very active going on in the invisible realm all the time, and that activity somehow has some impact on the visible realm. And when it does, a lot of times suffering comes from that because it's the enemy's game. He loves making people suffer. If you want to know somebody who really has your worst intent in mind, it's the devil. He loves to do that. That's his game. Now, this is real stuff. And it's part of the reason why evil is so prevalent. And I think that what's interesting in America is that because we don't think that this really counts for anything, the enemy actually moves completely undetected. And we are completely unaware. Hello, McFly. You know, we just don't think that somehow that the devil is actually at work in this, but he is. Now, I was writing this sermon in a coffee shop in San Diego on Friday. And as soon as I put the pen down to the sentence that suffering can come as a direct encounter from the spiritual realm, a woman comes and walks right into the coffee shop, 20 feet away from me. She said, there's a man that's just fallen down, you know, a homeless man that just fell down, is in a seizure right outside the door. I'm just like, what is that? And I went out and I prayed for him. I couldn't detect whether it was a spirit directly or not, but I just, you know, got my hands on him and moved him out because he was half on the street and half on the sidewalk. And I moved him up and we got somebody to call 911. But it was like, I know that the Lord is saying, hey, Bob, this is for real. Would you pay attention? You know, sometimes the Lord will do that. He'll get our attention with something a little bit more direct. The wake-up call is not a vibration. It's a clang, clang, and this was that. But this whole idea is something that we must take seriously. And I think that the way that we take this seriously is by asking God, what is the source of this suffering, Lord? It's not by just automatically assuming that this is always invisible realm and, invading the visible. But Lord, what's the source? And what is the comforting thing in the book of Job and what many theologians have surmised on the basis of is that God actually, this happens with God's permission and God's limitation, that's at work as well. God's permission and his limitations are at work as well. And again, this is very uncomfortable theologically because I think a lot of us would think, well, the Lord's just in control of everything. And I want to tell you that the Lord's is as in control as he wants to be and not any more than that. He is in control as he wants to be, and not any more than that. And in this, at least we see that the Lord gives permission, but he also gives limitation. He does not send the suffering, but he does allow it, and he curtails what the overall, you know, look and feel of that is going to be. Now for Job then, all hell breaks loose. And so in verse 13 to 19, it goes like this. So one day when Job's sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house, a messenger came from Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys were grazing nearby and the Sabians attacked and made off with them. And they put your servants to the sword and I am the only one, I'm sorry, I remember these, and I alone are the older translations, and I am the only one who had escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another messenger came in and said, the fire of God came down from the heavens, lightning, and et cetera, and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another messenger came and said, the Chaldeans formed three invading parties and swept down on your camels and made off with them, and they put your servants to the sword, and I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, I don't know if you remember the story that we learned in elementary school. This is a terrible, no good, very bad day. This is very much that. And while he was still speaking, yet another messenger came and said, your sons and daughters were feasting and drinking wine at your oldest brother's house, and suddenly a mighty wind swept in from the desert and struck the four corners of the house. It collapsed on them, and they are all dead. And I am the only one who has escaped to tell you. Now, this is catastrophic loss, isn't it? And this happens to any one of us. It's like, are you kidding me? Now, first it's his stuff. And, you know, it's curious that when we lose our stuff, or it gets taken from us, how we respond to the loss shows how we valued the stuff, whether it was in kind of idolatry category or it wasn't. But in reality, it's just stuff. How attached are we to our stuff? I think that kind of goes with this. Or to your house, your car, for me, a guitar, or your land, or your bike, or your motorcycle. I remember years ago I had a guitar made for me, a handmade guitar in Northern Ireland. And it was sent to me, and there were some problems with it, so I sent it to a repair place in New England. And the guy called me up, and he said, well, your guitar made it here, except for when you sent it, did it have a broken neck? And I remember, like, I'm going to throw up. You know, this is, it felt like somebody hit me in the solar plexus. I was like, and this showed, like, uh-oh. This has really got kind of idol status for me. But sometimes when our stuff is attacked, when we lose our stuff, it feels like we get an arm amputated from us or something, and it shows how much we value our stuff. But the reality is, it's just stuff. But then, now his kids are gone. All 10. All 10 kids are gone. And for me as a dad, and you've heard me talk about this before, my kids are on earth the most precious thing to me. The most precious thing to me. And for them to be gone, it's really catastrophic. His kids are everything to him. He does this intercession. He grieves for them. He's so concerned. They're the continuation of his line in ancient culture. They're his family circle. He adores them. They're gone. And it's brutal. And we hurt in proportion to our love. The more we love, the more we hurt. And Job is devastated. And then it says this. Here's Job's response at this. Job got up. He tore his robe, which is a sign of sorrow and contrition. And he shaved his head. And then he fell to the ground in worship and said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will depart. The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. May the name of the Lord be praised." It's the thing that we sing when we sing, "Blessed be the name of the Lord," which we sang last week. In all this, Job did not sin by charging God with wrongdoing. So I have to add a point that I didn't have in your when I printed out your bulletin insert. So we'll call this 2.5. That 2.5 is, when we go through tough times, it does reveal what's inside of us. And in this particular case, it has revealed what's inside of Job. That he truly is a man who trusts God. A man who does fear God, who is upright and is truly devoted to God, not just to what God gives. And so Job has, for those of us who like to use that test terminology, he has passed the test. But for us, it's important to say that it's the curious benefit of loss and pain is it does have this revealing sort of aspect to it. It shows what's really going on inside of us, and sometimes it's truly ugly. But when it is, the Lord is grabbing us by the hand and bringing us into that which is truly life. He's saying, "You've been camped out in death. I know you didn't see it, but I want to take you out of that death into real life." This is what Jesus does with us incessantly. But it's the loss of his kids that crushes him. Yet he does not rail against God. Incredible, really. I mean, think about this for yourself. Be honest. If these things happened to you, would you do what Job did? I don't know that I would. Or I think I would probably get to where Job got, but it might take me a little while. Just being honest, that I think that I would just be like, and we're going to get to some of that, but I you know, he is full of grief, and his grief is great. But the third thing that we see in this is that we can experience devastating loss and still trust God and his goodness. And that's one of the things that I get to actually say to people right and left. When they're going through really tough times, I get to say to them over and over again, you know, this is a really tough time. I want to acknowledge this. And God is still good. Because inside of the human spirit, there's this desire to put those two things together. If bad things are happening to me, then God somehow is mad at me, or God is bad. And they simply are two different things altogether. And this is one of the messages that we're going to be getting from Job over and over again, is that God is still good, but grief is a reality in this world. And Job is in devastating grief, but his grief isn't moving him away from God, but moving him toward God. And this is what the Apostle Paul is referring to in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, where he says, "Dear brothers and sisters, we want you to know, we want you to know what will happen when believers who have died, believers who have died, so that you will not grieve like people who have no hope." Now, interestingly enough, a lot of Christians would take that verse to say, we don't grieve because we know that these people have gone to heaven. That's not what's being said. No, he said, we just grieve differently. We do grieve. That Christians grieve. We feel the pain. We feel the loss. I mean, I'm grieving, you know, the Ziglago's going. It's real loss to me. I'm grieving that. But it's not like I'm grieving like anybody else would be, like I'm losing them forever. They're still part of my family. And Paul says, no, we don't grieve like people who have no hope, but we still grieve. And Job is in this grief, but his grief is not hopeless. And listen to what he does. I mean, this is incredible. It says he humbles himself before God. He throws himself down before God. And he says, you know what? All the stuff that I had, I didn't have it when I came into the world. I won't have it when I exit. All that stuff is just stuff. The kids, this is killing me. But Lord, you're the one who gets to decide what stays and what goes. You give and you take away. Blessed be your name. And in my heart, I think he probably said those words very slow. Not blessed be your name, but blessed be your name. He grieves, but his grief takes him toward the Master, not away. It's authentic human pain. It's honest. And it still is faithful to God. In the midst of his pain, he worships. In the midst of his pain, he worships. It's beautiful. I recall the best example I've ever seen of this with my own eyes was Tony and Nina. Their son, John, when he was in high school, had cancer. And I watched week after week as Tony and Nina lifted their voices and their hands to the Lord and worshiped him fully, and it crushed me. It was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen on this earth, that people in the midst of their pain can worship God with their whole hearts, because that's who they are. And that is actually what's happening with Job. He worships the Lord with his whole heart because it's who he is. And the fire has only showed what truly is. So, let me kind of go back and just reiterate, and then we'll close. That we saw firstly here that the invisible realm directly interacts with the visible realm, and suffering can come from that. That's one of the things that we can surmise from this. A second thing is that this happens, that God's permission and interaction are also at work within how that interaction works. That when we go through tough times and when we suffer, it reveals what's inside of us. It has a revealing effect, and we can experience these kinds of devastating losses and still trust God and his goodness. And so this comes back for me to a number of questions that we asked. Do you love God for the benefits package or for who he is? Do you love him because you're getting to go to heaven? And because I think that initially when we first get saved, we might just love the package a lot more. But once you get to know the Master, oh, I tell you, we just love him because we realize that the package, if you will, eternity with him, forgiveness of sins, Jesus' death on the cross, his love being poured out in our hearts, all these things are just extensions of who he is. And he's only acting true to himself. And we love him. Do you love him for the benefits package, or is it otherwise? Secondly, why do you do the things that you do? Why? I want to ask you to ponder that this week. And ask the Lord, why do I do the things that I do? And see what he says and see what he challenges. And if it looks ugly or uncomfortable, he's dealing with the real you. I mean, what can you do, you know? And with me as well. Last two things. If you are in grief and loss right now, the Lord is so near to you in your grief and loss. And I believe he wants to kind of pierce through that, to pull back the veil so that you can see that he has not distanced himself from you, not even a little bit, but that he has come close to you, and indeed you are enfolded. Even if you don't feel it, you are enfolded in the arms of love, in the arms of Almighty God. And he wants you to know that today. He wants you to experience that today. Last thing, and as I was praying for you this morning, I felt like the Lord said, you know, there are some people here that are going to show up that have actually considered suicide in the last month or two because their pain is just that great. And the Lord says, would you come to me? Would you bring all of that pain to me? Bring it all to me. Bring it all to me. Amen? Let's stand up.